We have never purchased an artifact nor sold an artifact, nor will we. Mainly because when we get people to give them to us, part of why they do it is because they know it's going to be preserved here forever. And when I go to a player after the World Series and I say, hey, well, can I have your bat that Miguel Rojas, when you hit this game-tying home run in Game 7, it's like an unbelievable piece of history. We want 100 years from now, his future generations of his family to come here. And if we were like, oh, well, sorry, we needed to build a new wing, so we sold your bat, it would go against everything that we've promised these people. And we've been promising that for 87 years.
Welcome to Self-Equity, the podcast that dives into the inspiring journeys of founders, entrepreneurs, athletes, and entertainers. I'm your host, Jolene Tepedino, authorized officer and team business manager for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group at UBS. Our guest today has one of the most unique perspectives in sports and leadership. Josh Rawich, president of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, has spent his career inside Major League Baseball and now leads an institution built on legacy. We talk about building career equity, thinking long-term about wealth, and what Josh has learned from Hall of Fame players across generations about money, identity, and life after peak earning years. Joining me as co-host on today's episode is Scott Zellniger, Managing Director with the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group. Hi, Josh. Great to see you. Welcome to our Self-Equity podcast. We are so excited to have you on today and can't wait to dive into your story.
Well, thank you. Look forward to catching up with both of you guys.
Josh, for anyone who doesn't know, what is the journey like to becoming the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Well, it is certainly not one that has been commonly traveled. There haven't been a whole lot of us that have done it, but I think the last handful who've been in this role came from the team side, where a lot of relationships are very important, being able to interact not just from in a club, major league clubhouse or with Hall of Famers, but also to have business sense and be able to run an institution of 100 some odd people. And it's a nonprofit museum, so there's certainly lots of people here with museum backgrounds. But in short, I guess it's been just an unbelievable journey and not one I ever imagined my career was going to take me to.
Tell us a bit about your journey. Where did you start? Did you ever think this is where you'd be? Love of baseball, all the good stuff.
I grew up in Southern California, from Los Angeles, and loved the game from a very, very young age. So certainly, like everybody else, dreamed of being a player, maybe being on the walls in Cooperstown someday. I don't know if I actually had that dream, but I think anybody that plays baseball knows about Cooperstown, knows about the Hall. And then I was very fortunate at 18 years old to get a internship with the LA Dodgers, which was my dream job, my dream team. And I spent about 15 years there. Minus a little stint where I left to be a reporter. And then basically around 2011, headed to the Arizona Diamondbacks for a decade, where I really was able to grow my career even further, learn about leadership, learn about corporate culture and how to build an organization, how to oversee an organization. And that led to about almost 5 years ago now, hearing from my predecessor here, who thought I might be good at this role. And shockingly, now I'm sitting in snowy Cooperstown. It's a truly unbelievable place. And anybody that's ever been, it's a sort of place you can't possibly forget. There was no way. And even when I got the call from the guy who had this job, I didn't think he was calling to ask if I was interested in this job. Like, there just is never a thought that this would be something that I could do. And yet I now look at it and think, man, I was training my whole life for this job that I never really realized existed because it's a perfect fit.
Josh, I would love to hear your young boy hat right now. So you grew up a fan of the Dodgers. Is there a player or two that you loved as a kid watching them play that you got the chance to meet and interact with and build a relationship with in your current role?
It's funny. I grew up as big a Dodger fan as there was on the planet and really all the way till I was 35 years old. So, I mean, it's every major name from Tommy Lasorda was the manager of the Dodgers when I was there. And I've spent countless hours with him over the years, kind of blowing my mind with crazy stories that kid Josh would never imagine. But the one that probably, if anybody was a Dodger fan in the 80s, they had a second baseman named Steve Sachs, who's my favorite player. It's who I modeled my playing career after. And I was just emailing with him yesterday. I've now gotten to know him very well over the years. But every time either an email or a text or a call comes in and it's him, I just kind of have to laugh. Like, this is kind of nuts. Like, the little kid in me quite often I find myself pinching myself at the office all day long.
It's got to be a surreal feeling. What do you think of the world of baseball today versus what it was when we were growing up? I mean, I'm 57 years old, presuming the players are of similar generation. The world has changed. The game has changed. The players, the mentality, the money. Yeah. What do you see as the big difference from the previous Hall of Famers to the ones that are going to be coming up in the future?
Well, certainly the finances have changed everything. I mean, you look at some of the guys who were inducted 30, 40, 50 years ago. They did not make the sort of life-changing money that allows them to just literally pass it down for 10 generations and not spend it all. So you certainly have modern players who have they're earning more than they ever did due to a number of factors that we can't dive into in depth. But the game itself in so many ways is still exactly the same. I mean, what's really cool about this is that 100 years ago, Babe Ruth was hitting from a 60-foot, 6-inch mound and running 90-foot bases, and the stadiums were basically the same in most cases. And so it does allow us to kind of compare the sport from generation to generation, even though the way they train is different and the analytics are different and so many things about the game are different. So much of it is the same. And if you talk to players, when you watch a Hall of Famer talk to a young player, which I just saw happen last week at spring training, they can still relate on every level because that Hall of Famer knows what it's like to be a 21-year-old trying to make the club or an established 27-year-old, or they know what it's like for their career to be over, and they can appreciate the journey of the young player.
Do you see a lot of interaction between, I call them, the alumni and the modern day player?
Yeah, a lot of teams have made that a priority to try to make sure that former players are around spring training. They're at the ballpark. Many of them are coaches. It's definitely changing. That's one of the things that I think is adjusting, is you're seeing more and more coaches who maybe came either from a collegiate background, maybe they didn't play professionally, but they're stepping into a coaching role. That just happened with the San Francisco Giants, just hired the University of Tennessee manager who has never been at a major league spring training until right now and is now suddenly responsible for overseeing it all. So it's, you're seeing that change, but there's definitely a lot of former ball players around the ballpark, spending time with young guys and teaching them the game.
So we're in the money business over here at UBS, so we many times look at it that lens. Do you sense a sense of resentment of former Hall of Famers with what guys are making today? I mean, there's definitely Hall of Famers that didn't make what the 25th man on the roster is making today. Do you get the sense that there's any animosity, any rub, or are they truly happy for them?
I think they're very happy for them. I think in a lot of cases they can look and understand, man, if I could have gone to free agency, I think there's curiosity. How much would I have been worth? Or if this guy can make that much, how much might I have made? But the reality is I think most of them also recognize they made way more than the people that came before them. And those people made more than the generation before them. That does just happen. It's happened exponentially. And so I'm sure there's some level of curiosity, but I wouldn't say animosity. I mean, I can only really speak to the Hall of Famers who they all hang out together here intergenerationally. And, Nobody's complaining about how come you made more than I did. It's I guess just the reality of the system.
Josh, what is the process for a player to be inducted into the Hall of Fame? Is it voting? Is it their statistics? How does that work?
There's actually two different ways in our Hall of Fame, and they're all different. That's part of what makes it kind of unique. But for us, you have the kind of recently retired players who, if you've played for 10 years in the big leagues, you're eligible to be on our ballot, and you have to wait until 5 years after you've retired. So basically 15 years after you're making your big league debut, in many cases, you end up on a ballot, and there's about 420 or so baseball writers who have covered the game for 10 or more years. They don't earn a vote until they've been covering the sport on a daily basis for 10 years. If you get 75% of that vote, you get elected. If you don't, as long as you get 5%, you can stay on that ballot and you keep getting looked at every year for 10 years. Now, let's say you get through that whole process and you don't get elected, you become eligible for the era committee process, which we look at different eras. So we have one that's pre-1980, we have post-1980, we have umpires, executives, and managers. And so that is a smaller electorate. It's about 16 people. Some of them are living Hall of Famers or executives who have been in the game for a very long time, historians. That group will get together once a year and look at a different era. Same bar you have to pass, 75%. So if you get 12 of the 16 votes there, you can get elected. But it is incredibly hard to get people to agree on 75% of any question in the world. And so we do really only elect about the top 1% of those who ever played. And that's probably different than a lot of the Halls of Fame, where Maybe the next class is the next best four or five players. For us, it's if we have nobody go in, we have nobody go in, and we're okay with that. If we have five people go in or seven people go in, we're okay with that too, but you've got to clear that 75% bar.
We know there was that steroid era, and there were some clear Hall of Famers from a production perspective that are not in the Hall of Fame. How do you handle that as an organization? Do you really just let the voting process take over? Is there some type of conversations that go on behind the scenes? What's that like?
It's a fair question and one we get asked a lot, but ultimately we don't really have any say in whether or not they get elected. That's actually one of the very smart things that happened many, many years, going back to the very beginning, is that the Hall doesn't get a vote. I have told several players who either are known PED users because they tested positive or they admitted to it, or in some cases accused PED users. I've said, if you get 75% of the vote, we will treat you exactly the same as anybody else, and we will put your plaque in the gallery. That said, we also do encourage voters, both in both processes, the writers and the era committee, to consider character and integrity and in sportsmanship. And we don't tell them what that means because we don't want to tell them how to consider. They can decide that on their own. But again, that 75% bar is hard to cross. And so in some cases, some of the people you're referring to may have gotten 65, 70% of the vote. They did not get the 75%. What I think is really important that most people don't realize, unless you've been to Cooperstown, is it's not just a plaque gallery in the middle of a village. Like, there is a three-story museum here filled with 40,000 artifacts and 3 million documents and all these incredible things. And so the story of that era and the users of PEDs and all this, that's all told very clearly, very bluntly, without pulling punches, because we want people to, and we tell stories of racism, we tell stories of sexism, we tell stories that need to be told, because we're a historical organization and our job is to tell it the way it is, not to sugarcoat it.
That's a really helpful answer to me, and I'm sure others that are going to be listening to this, because one of the concerns I've always had with these Hall of Fames is, whether it's baseball or any other major sports, there are people that get left out, but how do you tell the history of the game without these people in it? And it sounds like you've actually essentially accounted for that.
We very often, people will say, well, how can you tell the story of baseball without Pete Rose? And the answer is we don't. Pete Rose has tons of artifacts around the museum. And we tell stories about people that you've never heard of either. I mean, the reality is that there are so many people that contributed to this. And we're a separate entity from Major League Baseball. We're an independent nonprofit. So it's not just the MLB Hall of Fame either. We tell the story of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and we tell the stories of the Negro Leagues and baseball in Latin America. We tell all these stories about baseball. I mean, it's all inclusive in so many different ways. And that's, I think, what makes this place so special.
Josh, tell us a little bit about the collection in the museum. How is it curated? You know, are these personal memorabilia from families or just from games? And then also around that, if you could talk a little bit about the funding, how do you go out and get donors and, you know, make sure that everything is as it should be at the museum?
Two great questions. So the collection is just the most vast you could ever imagine. And I would say it comes in two different ways. There is a lot of stuff that happens in real time. A no-hitter gets thrown and we will make a phone call to the clubhouse that night and say, would so-and-so be willing to donate their hat? And usually within an hour, we'd have the answer back. And I'd say 99 times out of 100, the person is really honored to have something in the Hall of Fame. I'd say about half the stuff we get during the year comes in directly from the field. Either I've myself and another colleague goes to the World Series. And when it's over, we'll be in the clubhouse gathering eight or nine things that will help tell the story of the World Series or the All-Star Game or the World Baseball Classic. So a lot of it happens that way. But then a ton of it probably happens from people that are listening to the podcast who look and they go, oh, you know what? My grandparents willed me down this glove and they told me it belonged to Ty Cobb. Like, I wonder if it really did. And we get calls all the time. Documents, photos. We just had a meeting this morning that was our accessions meeting for archives and library, where you're looking at things people are offering us. And then we have to determine, is it something we want? Is it something we have the provenance that we can prove it is what they think it is? And then can we pay to keep it? I mean, it's not inexpensive to have temperature and humidity and light controlled vaults and all the things that you need to preserve these things forever. So I guess that speaks to your second question, which is the fundraising process. There's a number of ways. We do have individual members, so it's not very expensive to become a member of the Hall of Fame, and you get magazine and you get paraphernalia and other cool things to wear or whatever. Tens of thousands of people who do that. But then we also have very, very large benefactors who might give 6- and 7-figure gifts, either to put their name on a gallery of an exhibit or their name on the archives or their name on a room at the Hall of Fame. And that happens kind of in the same way that any other nonprofit would do that. Tax deductible and a great way for people to spend their money, I believe.
I mean, one of the things that people, I don't know, realize, but I mean, our mission is essentially three things. We preserve history, we just talked about. We honor excellence, that's the plaque gallery. And then we connect generations in a way that I just don't think you can understand until you're walking around here and you see a grandparent saying, oh, I used to love watching Mickey Mantle, and the parent's going, I used to love Don Mattingly, and the kid says, I love Aaron Judge. And it just, you see this every single day going on around here and people walking on Main Street. I mean, it's like a Hollywood, my wife and I often joke, it's like a Hallmark movie set. You just, sometimes we'll be walking to dinner and you're like, is this even real? Like these look like facades, and it's a real place with 1600 residents in the village. And then it multiplies by, I don't know, tens of thousands of people in the summer from visitors and Hall of Fame weekend, where we could have 50, 60, 70,000 people show up here. And somehow this tiny little village pulls off an amazing world-class event every single year.
So I can relate to what you just said. I took my family up there, I think it was 2001. And I'm looking at the 69 Mets and Tom Seaver. And my son was infatuated with Mark McGwire. It was right around the time that,
yeah,
he and Sammy, yeah, were battling it out. And, you know, it connects generations. And then I saw players, you know, my dad used to follow Whitey Ford and guys like that. So I 1,000% agree with you how it connects generations. I always said that sports does that.
Yeah. And in fact, actually, the name Seaver just made me think of a story you were asking. I mean, unfortunately, I never got to meet Tom, but his daughter, after Tom passed, his daughter came to Cooperstown for the 2022 induction ceremony. And she said, I needed to do this for closure because I just had to be here when my dad can't be here. And so I'm walking with her to a party for Gil Hodges, who's getting posthumously inducted. And there's a guy outside the party waiting. And he says, are you Tom Seaver's daughter? And she says, yeah. And she starts getting emotional and saying how she needed to be there because her dad. And he says, well, I'm here because of my dad. And I told my dad I would never come to Cooperstown until Gil Hodges got inducted. And they both start crying and hugging these two random strangers in the street. And I had been on the job for like 5 months at that point. I was like, this is crazy. Like, it's just, it connects people in just unbelievable ways. And I mean, that's just one example of a million that happened here.
What are a couple other names where you've developed real serious personal relationships?
Well, it's interesting. When we go through the process of inducting people, I would say I'm probably closer with the people in recent years, whether it's Fred McGriff and Scott Rowland, or Ichiro Suzuki last year, and CeCe Sabathia and Billy Wagner, the people who you wind up helping through the process, you're going to wind up getting closer with, as well as those who come back quite a bit. And so Wade Boggs loves to come back here. He comes back, and I played golf with him many number of times. Lee Smith is another great reliever who I just absolutely love spending. He just makes you laugh. Having grown up a Dodger fan, spending time with Sandy Koufax is just boggles my mind when it happens. So, I mean, it's we don't like to choose favorites, but I mean, the reality is the people that come back the most often and the ones that we get to know. And in fact, I mean, I'm leaving in a couple of days. I only met Bill Mazeroski once, but he passed away last weekend, and I'm going to go to his funeral on Monday to kind of represent the Hall of Fame. And you realize, like, just kind of what a special group of people this is. There's only 77, 78 living Hall of Famers at a given time, and getting to know their families and spend time with them and understand who they are as humans is, I think, frankly, those are the ones that I'm closer with that I've gotten to know on a human level beyond just what they did on the field.
Given the dynamics of how athletes get paid, particularly the ones from a little further back, where they made their money over 10 years, 15 years, typically at a young age, you know, the average person that goes to work every day, it's the opposite. They don't make a lot of money when they're young, and then they make it over a longer period of time. We always see a different dynamic. Again, like the new wave Hall of Famer, they're making so much money, I don't think a lot of this applies. But Has there been any help with helping people figure out, you know, how to live the rest of their lives? If you're 50 years old and you've been in the Hall of Fame and you didn't make a ton of money 30 years ago, is there anything in place from the Hall of Fame? Is there counseling? Is there education?
It's a great question. We don't do that. But I mean, I do know that in almost every instance, they have obviously financial advisors and agents who have in many ways been telling them for years, like, you may have made $10 million when you played, but that when you take away the taxes and the agent fees and everything else and what's left to make you live for the next 30 years or 40 years. And quite often they may not have gone to college because they've got drafted out of high school. And so we do not offer that. But I know that the league as well, Major League Baseball, educates these players starting as soon as they get drafted as prospects to try to help them understand you can't help every single cousin and friend who asks you for something. You can't buy three nice cars right now and have a massive house and expect that it's all still going to be there. It's weird because I do think people look and they go, how could you possibly spend $15 million? And it's like, I'm not continuing to earn money every year. It's weird. I mean, nobody wants to hear anybody who's in that world cry poor, and they don't. But I think there's a realization that you can't just help everybody you've ever met with, oh, yeah, I'll just pay for your vacation or pay for your private plane or whatever it is. It's not a realistic way. But at the Hall, we don't really get involved on that level. We really, that's just not something we've done.
At the Hall level, does the league or teams invite you in to talk to their rookies?
Not like en masse, though. We've done. I did go actually. MLB had a prospect camp in Arizona a couple years ago that I came and spoke to. But what we do, I just got done doing about 8 days in Arizona spring training, and I'll go to Florida next week. I do try to get to as many spring training camps as possible to spend time with either future Hall of Famers, established stars, and in some cases, this time was the first time I had met the couple of the great rookies on the A's that just wound up. Jacob Wilson and Nick Kurtz are both like future superstars in the game. And we get to know them, and maybe one of them goes on to a Hall of Fame career, and 25 years from now, I'm standing on stage with them. Or maybe they don't, maybe they fizzle out. But ultimately, we try to get to know them as much as possible. And like you said, maybe dangle a carrot of, what's crazy is when you walk up to somebody and you say, I'm with the Baseball Hall of Fame, that's the easiest. Everybody wants to talk about it. In many cases, they want to talk about how they came to Cooperstown when they were 12 years old and played in a tournament here, because there's so many kids that play in the tournaments we have here. But even if they never did, they want to talk about who they think belongs in the Hall of Fame or who's going in this year or any number of cool things. And it's arguably the easiest opening line you could have when you walk up to any human being. So
we watched the game change, and you know, you've been a fan of the game since you're a kid, like I have been, and you watch pitching. I just want to focus on pitching for a second, because to me, that's been the biggest change in the game. I remember going to the Hall of Fame, and they had a video in one of the rooms, and it was 73 World Series. What struck me is it was late in the game, eighth or ninth inning, and there was a man on second, and the starting pitcher was pitching and continuing to pitch second and third. It didn't matter, right? I don't remember who it was. Game today, by the fifth inning, they're rotating through the bullpen. What impact does that have on legacy? And how do you keep, you know, comparing eras? Like, how do you look at a starting pitcher today versus then? The numbers aren't even close.
Yeah, and I think that the reality is the numbers weren't close between the guys that pitched in the late 1800s and early 1900s versus the 1930s and 40s. So, I mean, the numbers do change. There was just a great story, actually, there were a couple of them recently, because there was a pitcher, Felix Hernandez, who made a huge jump on our ballot this year, I think 30-40% growth from 1 year to the next. And people started saying, you know, his numbers aren't the same as the traditional 300-game winners. And it led to a series of articles on ESPN and The Athletic and everywhere else about what is the new Hall of Fame pitcher going to look like. I think the reality is what you're leaving it in the hands of an electorate that watched this person pitch and that said, was this one of the top 1% of the pitchers in baseball when they were pitching? And so if that, who knows, 30 years from now, it might be that people only throw two innings a game, and then you're going to have to look and go, okay, well, who are the best two inning pitchers? And it's happened over time where closers didn't exist before, and now they're in the Hall of Fame. I think it's hard when if you're going to take a pitcher from 2025 and compare them to a pitcher from 1973, even an average pitcher in 73's numbers are going to look different than the current person. But I don't think our electorate would look at that and say, okay, well, that's how you determine a Hall of Famer. The Hall of Famer is really, are you in the top 1%? Were you the best of the best when you were playing? And that's really how they seem to this point, consider the voting. But you know, it's a fair question. And it's one we get a lot with. The answer is we're going to see how the electorate considers that in the future, because we don't really know at the moment.
So when you wake up in the morning and you're the president of Hall of Fame, what are your responsibilities day to day? What does that look like?
Well, ultimately the president of any organization, obviously my job is to along with our leadership team, set the vision and put forth a plan that we're going to execute over the course of the year. And we have all sorts of cool stuff that we're going to do in the year ahead. So clearly that's probably one of the big things I do. Fundraising is another big part of it. We're always looking at how are we going to fund these amazing things we want to do here. And then obviously being in some ways the liaison to the Hall of Famers, to the current major league executives. Most days I'm in touch with some club executive, whether it's an owner or a president or a general manager or a public relations person. That's why relationships matter so much, just like in any industry. But I mean, the fact that I can walk into almost any spring training site last week and know 15 to 20 people, from coach's manager to bat boy or clubhouse attendant to the owner. That's part of what I think they were looking for in this role, but also, like I said, a business sense. So it's not all that dissimilar than other nonprofits, where we have finance and administration and people and culture and retail and sponsorship and development, all these things that ultimately I don't think people walk into the hall and they think about that, but all those things happen here just like any other business.
In your opinion, is the Baseball Hall of Fame going to stay in Cooperstown forever, or would relocation to a bigger city?
I hope not. I hope it never goes anywhere else. I mean, this place is so special. And that's something Ichiro said when he got elected, was like, there's this town just for baseball and you can go there and you can feel this crazy peace. It would not be the same if it was in Manhattan or Vegas or Orlando or Los Angeles. And that doesn't mean that we might not someday have a reason to do traveling exhibits, which we've done before, or create things that allow people to experience a piece of it somewhere else. I never say never, but ultimately we believe that this is the absolute perfect place for it. It's just such a special place. And I think it loses some of that if it's just, and this is not a knock on the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame, but it is in the Tokyo Dome. It is literally, you go to the Tokyo Giants game and you just walk on your way in, you just go swing by and you see the Hall of Fame. There's something special about having to make a journey here and come to Cooperstown. And even in the dead of winter, we've got probably 50 people milling around the museum today amidst the snow and cold weather, because it's been on their bucket list forever. So I think it loses a lot of that if you were to ever move it. And baseball may not have been created here, but we have become the spiritual home of baseball, and I certainly wouldn't want to see it move.
Yeah, when I did take my family up there, there was a feel. You get out of the car, there's just a feel in the area, just where business is going and money is going these days. I just wonder if, and you answered it, but
yeah, I think the benefit of being a nonprofit is that we're not driven by like let's pull every dollar out of this thing we possibly could. That's just not, it's not our mission. Are there things we can do to raise more revenue and to be able to build newer and better exhibits, of course, and take care of the collection with more vaults and all the things that we need to do? Yes, that does require increasing revenue year over year, but it's not about how can we just get every penny out of every visitor. And that's what happens, obviously, sometimes when you're a for-profit venture versus nonprofit.
To my next question, Josh, let's talk a little bit about your career and the pivot from, you know, spending 27 seasons, you know, with the MLB operations, Dodgers, Diamondbacks, to leading a nonprofit museum. I mean, it probably has to be one of the steepest learning curves of all time, for-profit to non-for-profit.
It is, like I said earlier, it's not something I ever imagined. I kind of figured I'd be at the teams forever. And when this opportunity came up, understanding what we're all about was part of the interview process, interviewing with a board of directors and not with the club president or the club owner. You very quickly understand what you don't know. And so I've spent a lot of the first year, but certainly, I mean, we have trained museum professionals. There's probably about half of our staff has a advanced degree in library studies or curatorial or preservation, conservation, collection. They've gone to museum studies programs. And so learning from them constantly about what do museums do, how do they do it. I'm never going to be the expert on that. And they're not going to be the expert on baseball and how necessarily how you take a customer from thinking about an idea of coming to the Hall of Fame till the day they die and leave us in their will. I mean, that's really part of what we're trying to do is figure out how do we like keep this customer journey. So, I mean, it was a lot of listening, still is a lot of listening. And I probably talk too much already, but I try very hard to understand the things I don't know, try very hard to rely on the people. And the meeting we had this morning, I mentioned where we're looking at all of the offerings for archives. I'm in there mainly just to hear. I just want to understand what are the cool things people are offering us. And then if somebody, I might just ask a question like, hey, what do we think about photographs from the 1920s? And how do we determine that these are real versus AI? Or how do we decide if this was really the glove used by so-and-so? But most of the time it's asking a lot of questions. And you are correct. It was a very steep learning curve, but I think now I've been here almost 5 years. I feel like I've got a pretty good grasp on it. And I will still keep learning till the day I die.
Josh, you got my wheels spinning on something here. So you mentioned that you get thousands of artifacts, right? People are sending in that you obviously can't display everything you have. The memorabilia market is so strong right now, and fundraising is a big part of your business. Do you ever allow yourselves to sell and raise money that way?
We don't. There are some museums that it's part of their collection policy that they can do that. We have never purchased an artifact nor sold an artifact, nor will we, mainly because when we get people to give them to us, part of why they do it is because they know it's going to be preserved here forever. And when I go to a player after the World Series and I say, hey, well, can I have your bat that Miguel Rojas, when you hit this game-tying home run in Game 7, it's like an unbelievable piece of history. We want 100 years from now, his future generations of his family to come here. And if we were like, oh, well, sorry, we needed to build a new wing, so we sold your bat, it would go against everything that we've promised these people. And we've been promising that for 87 years. So we don't ever do that. We have this unbelievable Rockwell painting, the famous, famous Rockwell painting that probably could change all of our fortunes in 3 minutes if we would ever go that route. And it's just not something we ever consider doing, think about doing. Everything we have in this building is one of a kind. The moments that they come from, you can't replace it. You can't go find another bat and ball from Hank Aaron's 715th home run, or you name it, from any given moment. They're all one of a kind.
So what do you envision your legacy being when Josh wraps it up, whenever that might be, 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road? What's the legacy? What do you want to be remembered for in the Hall of Fame?
I think just having hopefully left this place better than when I got here, making an impact on the people around me. I mean, there have not been very many presidents here, as people stay for a very long time in this role. And you can see in a lot of ways what projects came in and what I speak a lot about, and what I encourage our team to think about, and what they do think about, whether I encourage it or not, is how do we keep this place relevant for the next generation of fans? And that's ultimately, I know that you, when you went there, when you came here in 2001, you loved it. And if you came here now, I think you'd love it. I need to make sure that a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 23-year-old who comes in here now and 20 years from now is still going to love it the same way that we all did. And so it's a different experience. It's more touchscreens, and it's more interactivity, and it's more engagement, and all these things that I think, hopefully when my time here is done, people will look and say, yeah, he helped us move in that direction to keep this place relevant, so that this place was around long before me, and it's going to be around long after me. And that's very different than if you start your own company and you're building it from the ground up. I'm trying to maintain something, and our team is trying to maintain something here that lasts forever. And that's a long time. Forever is a long time.
A long time. Well, that summarizes the legacy you're looking for, right? Yeah. Keep it going forever. And you are a big part of it. You mentioned that there's only been a few. Do you know how many presidents there's been?
I think I was 8 or 9. And yeah, that's crazy. One gentleman had it for 25 some odd years. I'm nearly 50. I don't think I'm going to match his mark, but I hope I'm here for a long time.
Josh, one question we like to ask every guest on the podcast is, what does sweat equity mean to you?
I mean, I think a lot of times people will think of sweat equity as what you're not getting paid for. You're putting, you're getting equity out of something that you're not necessarily drawing a salary for. But in baseball, you spend so much of your early years in the game just working crazy hours, crazy, crazy hours for not a lot of money, not a lot of prestige, not a lot of anything. And I think to me, sweat equity is the what you do when no one's looking. How hard do you work when nobody's paying attention? How deeply do you care about the entity you're working for that you just put in the extra effort because it's the right thing to do and not because it's what someone's paying you to do? And I've been crazy lucky that I've worked in only jobs where it didn't bother me to put in sweat equity. Yeah, I guess that's what it means to me.
I have one last question from my seat. Of the Hall of Famers that are no longer with us, from stories you've heard from others, are there a couple that you really wish you got to meet, either because you heard they were really kind-hearted, they were really fun? Are there just a couple names where it's like, gosh, I really wish I met that guy?
Interestingly, I'd say that the two names I did meet literally for like a shake of hand before I had this job, but Hank Aaron and Willie Mays are talked about in such reverence here. Hank Aaron donated his entire collection and what he dealt with, literally every artifact he ever had, he gave to us. What he went through in life is unfathomable for most human beings, and I really wish I'd have gotten to know him the way my predecessors did. They rave about him. Willie Mays falls into that category. I got a chance to say hello to him a couple times, but when you're talking about one of the greatest people on the planet to ever do what they did, unfortunately, we were bringing his plaque to Rickwood Field, where they were playing a game in Rickwood a couple years ago, which was a Negro League stadium that's still standing that he played in many years ago. And myself and a colleague were bringing his plaque to this game to help kind of let fans feel Willie's presence, because he couldn't be there. He was going to be in California. And on the drive to the airport, we learned that he passed away, and we were literally like driving his plaque to his hometown. And the kind of, I don't know, circle of life nature of that moment just hit me like, man, what I would give to be sitting down with Willie right now and just hearing about his life. So there's a bunch of others too, whose names necessarily don't resonate on that level with fans, but that the people in the offices here just rave about. Robin Roberts, they say, was just an amazing guy to hang out and be around. And Gaylord Perry, people that would come to the hall and just whatever we needed, they would do whatever you wanted. And I never got to meet these people. So, you know, you keep passing those stories down and you hope that the version of those people in the future, whoever's in this seat years from now, will say, oh man, I wish I got to meet Lee Smith or Jim Tomei or whoever. So, yeah, it's part of the joy of this job.
You have a website that people can donate on?
As you're coming in or going out, baseballhall.org. I think really the key for us is often just getting people to come once, because once you've come here and you've realized what this place is, you want to become a member, you want to become a donor, you want to keep engaging with us. So certainly encourage everybody to go to baseballhall.org, see what we've got going on. And as I like to say, take it off of your bucket list and put it on your to-do list and hopefully get to see people in Cooperstown.
Josh, thank you for joining us today on our Self Equity podcast. It was amazing hearing more about you and your journey. You are a Hall of Famer, and your path has been iconic. We wish you the best. Look forward to seeing you again and continued success at the Hall of Fame.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to seeing you guys down the road.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.